Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey everyone, welcome to the 293rd episode of Just Shoot It, a podcast about filmmaking, screenwriting, and directing. This episode is brought to you by our MVP patron, Christopher Weil. I'm Oren Kaplan.
And I'm Matt Enlow. Today we have Christine Weatherup and Beatrice Chaheen on the show to talk about their new film, See You Next Christmas. They're two of my very best pals, which we sometimes say on the show, but in this case it's literally actually true because I am married to Christine and co-produced the film with B. So it's a real treat. This is a movie for regular listeners. You'll recognize the film. This is the one that I shot way back at the beginning, right before the pandemic, and have been in post and delivery on. A lot of the anecdotes over the last year have been direct references to producing this film. So it's a really fun opportunity for us to kind of dig in and talk about the film specifically. So it's exciting. Yeah, I'm kind of like half hosting and half guesting on this episode, along with Christine professionally, but Chrissy, my wife, who wrote, directed, and stars in the film, and B, who is a longtime producing partner. You know, I think we dig in on a lot of the things that I have dabbled with talking about on the show. We get the chance to really kind of dig in on more. Like, I think your main question really is like, well, not just why direct, but why make an indie movie?
Yeah. Like knowing that there is...
That it's hard and that you've already bit off a lot of different challenging tasks. And that...
Yeah. And that there's an odd ceiling for indie films. Like, to me, the main reason you... There are two reasons you would make an indie film, right? And I think we talked about this in the interview. Either to make money... In some weird way, like we'll make it for X amount of money and we'll try to sell it for 2 times X amount of money. Or to really introduce yourself as a filmmaker to the people that watch indie films, which is a small subset of people that watch, you know, movies in general.
Yeah, I hear that. And I think Chrissy does a very good job of being like, well, why can't it be both? And I think that's what her aim was. And I think to a certain extent has achieved that. But I think also if you look at literally all of your favorite filmmakers, they all started doing it this way. Do you know what I mean? Like, literally, Eternals opened this weekend, and like Chloe Zhao obviously was doing indies for a long time before she did her Marvel movie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, no one lets you make a studio feature until you've made a movie. Like, no one thinks you can make a movie until you've made a movie. Full stop. You know?
Right. Yeah. And I guess, you know, it's interesting. It's just interesting to see, especially in today's climate where there's just like the peak TV world, you know, and if these indie
again,
films.
I mean, I think you look at all, like, show me a filmmaker who didn't get started in indie film.
Your friend Brenna. I don't know. Like, I think.
Sorry. So you can either win a Student Academy Award or win a, but that's actually that's the real answer is like, you have to break out somehow. And so some people break out really young in film school. John Chu is another example, right? Or you have to break out. If you don't break out at 18, 19, or 22, pardon me. If you don't break out at 22, then the other option is make something, just shoot it until people recognize it. Sometimes it's a feature. Sometimes that's a great commercial. But for the most part, I think, like I said, you don't get to make more features or prove yourself doing narrative until you have done some meaningful narrative, basically.
Yeah. No, I mean, the thing is, I know it's the thing to do. It's the right move. I guess I'm just, it's like when you have someone that's like pretty successful at what they're doing already, and then they open up a can of,
of existential worms. Yeah.
It's interesting. And so we talk about that for about 10 seconds in this movie.
I think we talk about it for a little bit more than that.
But we talk about all the other fun things. And yeah, I mean, I guess my last question, I know we were going to do a super short intro on this, but is I feel like you kind of don't take advantage of the podcast to promote your stuff as much as you could. Is that intentional?
I was about to do it. I was about to go for it.
You're about to tell people how to watch See You Next Christmas?
Yeah, See You Next Christmas. It is seeyounextchristmasmovie.com. So it is available to watch on iTunes, Amazon, all the places that you watch movies, Vudu. And is a very charming, very... I think it's a great movie. And having watched it with a lot of audiences, a lot of people are really connecting with it in a way that's gratifying and fun and rewarding and a relief. Do you know what I mean? Like, you can watch a movie and think like, oh, I really like this, and I love what we were aiming for and think that we hit that mark, but you never know until you watch it with people, and then to see people and to watch the film win awards and connect with people and for them to rally behind it is special and cool. So, but I did want to tell people what the movie's about also, because I don't think that we really dig in on that. So See You Next Christmas is the story of, it's a romantic comedy set in kind of like an indie world that takes place over the course of 6 Christmas parties. So the story only takes place during that actual party. And so we drop in on characters once a year who are growing and interacting with each other. And there's a main couple that sort of meets at the first party. And it's a will they, won't they sort of question as people grow, and the ensemble kind of shifts and changes. And it's got all of the questions about like what your chosen family is, and you know, what it is to be a young person and celebrating the holidays and growing and aging, and kind of a lot of like pretty resonant themes to us that we've realized have like clicked with audiences over the years. And it's about being young, it's about aging, it's about being a little older. What do we want out of life? All the existential crises that we talk about on the show, including Oren's. And so yeah, it's a really charming, really funny, fun, unconventional Christmas rom-com. It tickles all of the things that you want out of a rom-com, and also I think delivers the character-based comedy and fun and rough around the edginess of an indie comedy as well.
Yeah, and my pitch for it is, especially to this insanely niche audience that happens to listen to your podcast, is that it's based on Matt and Chrissy's real life. They really do have this annual Christmas party, and there is a character in the movie based on Matt, regardless of Matt denying it. So if you hate romantic comedies, but you like this podcast, you should still watch the movie, because there's Matt, there's a character based on Matt in the movie. And he's almost more likable than the real Matt.
Yeah, certainly more likable than the real Matt. Also, I think it's worth it to point out as a little lesson, as something that's obvious to people who, if they thought about it for a second, but probably haven't. So the way that pre-orders work for iTunes in particular is every single pre-order of a movie counts towards the day one numbers on iTunes. And so you're like, well, who the heck pre-orders a movie? The answer is not that many people. Right. And so it is the most significant way. When your friends are on Facebook or on Instagram and they're like, pre-order the movie, please. It is an incredibly effective way to show your support of the film, because basically that means that your movie, your purchase counts towards the day one ticket sales, which is about spiking the algorithm. Right. So if you're going to rent the movie or buy the movie at any point, doing it in advance inadvertently gives them the chance to climb the ladder especially quickly. And so specifically doing it on pre-ordering on Amazon and stuff, I don't think is really an option. So like, we were really all about that iTunes pre-order. And what's impressive is that, like, because no one pre-orders a movie, a relatively small number, we're talking 50, 100, 200, makes a really dramatic difference that first day in terms of spiking it.
So if you're not part of our Patreon and feel guilty about it, in the same way that I feel about the NPR drives that they do, then go pre-order the movie.
And we'll have I ever told you that we donated our car to NPR?
I think you mentioned it.
Yeah. When you hear that, they're like, hey, a good way to support NPR is to donate your car to us. And you're like, who the heck would do that?
Oh, no. I've looked into it. My stepdad is like, it's actually cheaper for me to donate the car and use it as a write-off than to sell it.
Or even like if it's a junker and it doesn't run, then they'll to tow it. Yeah, they'll pick it up. So like if you don't want to spend money on a tow truck, I mean, that's the rationale. Anyway, rather than donating your car, do me a favor, take a or, you know, rate it on iTunes, rate it on Letterboxd. All of that stuff is a pretty significant way. So if you've learned something from this movie over the past year, and I suspect if you've listened regularly, you probably did, and you want to watch a good movie, see you next Christmas.
Yes, check it out.
You can watch it with your family, and I think it actually is pretty good for everybody. You know, maybe if you have young kids around, there's some like aggressive making out early on, but otherwise, you know, it's pretty family friendly.
Wait, am I still in a few frames of the movie?
You are. You are.
Okay. Yeah. If you guys tell us the approximate minute mark of where you see me, you need eagle eyes though.
Yeah. Then it'd be pretty hard.
Email us justshootapod@gmail.com and we'll mention your name. Even promote your website if you want us to.
Awesome. Well, without any further jibber jabber, let's talk to Christine Weatherup, Beatrice Chaheen, and me.
And Matthew.
Matt and Lowe, right after some messages.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound. And you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
So my first question is to Chrissy. You made this movie. See you next Christmas.
Correct.
Why did you make it?
Do you mean what was the inspiration for the script or why did I mean, I wanted to make a feature. We had another feature we were moving toward making that was expensive. And so, you know, after waiting a while to get the money for that feature, you know, you wait long enough. And I had heard this podcast, Just Shoot It. And it just reminded me I should just go shoot a movie. But genuinely, I was waiting for a long time. And this was a more producible script. And so, you know, I had the idea because I myself throw an annual holiday party. And I wrote this script sort of, not as an homage, but I think that was sort of the kernel for it. And we had access to a location, our own apartment, where we threw the party. And That just got everything going, the momentum.
It does make me think of, there was a moment a few years back where we had Sarah Adina Smith on the show, and she told a story about how she had the money for a feature and then it fell apart. And so she only had $50,000 or whatever. You know, we went back and forth. And at a certain point, she was like, what are you waiting for? No one's going to give you $1 million to make your movie. It's not going to happen.
Especially your first movie.
Yeah.
Well, I guess I'm asking even in a more primal way, like why do you, Chrissy, why did you want to make a feature film?
I'm guessing you're getting at it because my background is as an actor.
So I think that's like interesting about it, but also it's something that actually ever since the beginning of this podcast, we don't really bug people about this a lot because we don't know them as well as we know you. But there has been this question of like, why even make like a low budget feature? You know, like what's the point?
Well, I'll take the question out of the low budget for a second. I mean, I think I always knew I wanted to work on both sides of the camera. I think, you know, sort of to connect it as an actor. I think as an actor, the joy of acting is you go into somebody else's project and you enter their world, and it's, you know, exciting to be just brought into somebody else's playground. But it's different when you make something yourself, when you're the driving force. And I think when the three of us made the short Killed in Action, and I remember distinctly after we shot it that day, I was like, for the first time, I felt like I had a voice. And I didn't ever feel like as an actor, I was missing a voice. But I think there was something about, you know, this was my vision in a way that I had never felt before. And there was something really exciting about that.
Yeah. And I would say time and again, we talk to filmmakers on the show, sometimes even off mic, know that their lives changed because of that first feature, even if it was a small one.
Like their careers, you mean, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And so B, is that why were you interested in making kind of this small feature?
Well, you know, primarily I work in TV space. So for me, and, you know, under the big studio system. So for me, doing an indie film with good friends is something that was really appealing to me, you know, having done KIA and then having done Swearsville. I mean, that's how I met Chrissy and Matt. And so we've been friends at this point for 11 years, which is wild. Yeah. I mean, for me, that's something different and exciting. I mean, it is fun to do, you know, big shows, but it's also fun to have a part in a project that is so, it's so personal where, you know, you're kind of, we're all doing everything as opposed to having a bunch of different people sort of chime in from different aspects, which, I mean, it's good because that my experience in TV does influence and did influence a lot of the way that I produced See You Next Christmas, but it's something different and exciting. And I love rom-coms. So a lot of it was, there were so many things that drew me to it.
I think low budget also can have a bad connotation, but I find the stories that I like often work really well in a low budget space. So low budget to me isn't necessarily, I mean, of course we would love to have a bigger budget to play with, but I think, you know, there are stories that can be told in low budget films that are exciting and interesting and character driven and all the things that appeal to me as a filmmaker and a moviegoer.
Yeah, no, and for sure. And I hope I didn't come off.
No, I'm not
like negative about the low budget thing. I guess I think to me there is like, if you're making a movie on a smaller budget, like under $1 million movie, you're either doing it to like make money, right? You're making like some horror film and you're hoping it turns into Paranormal Activity, or you are doing it as, you know, a way to kind of show off your talents, like a Greta Gerwig type of film, you know, and like launch your career as like a writer, actor, creator, filmmaker.
Well, in a sense, I think that, I mean, hopefully this movie could do both in that while it's not horror, I think the holiday Christmas genre can act in it works in a certain way. You don't need big stars and big budgets the same way you might in a romantic comedy, but setting it at Christmas, suddenly you have an audience who's just hungry for Christmas content. So maybe I could check off both boxes and do the horror genre and Greta Gerwig move.
Yeah, for sure. No, that's a good point. I think just something like super specific to your movie that I think is interesting, and it's, I'm assuming like part of the reason like I was excited about the movie and that B was excited about the movie is because, you know, to the listeners that don't quite know what the movie is about, it is about this annual Christmas party, and it's told over six different years of this holiday party, and about a relationship that is born out of two people meeting at this holiday party and how their relationship evolves over these 6 years. And I think something that's probably fun for like B and me is we were at your parties, you know? And so like, it just kind of occurred to me right now that like, if you make a movie based on something from your life that other people experienced with you, it's probably, they have some vested interest in like working on the movie too. It's kind of like an interesting thing to keep in mind when you're trying to figure out what the movie to make is. So you made it about this party that you host. So you obviously know the ins and outs of the party. You know the ins and outs of the characters that come to your party. And you literally like own the location where it takes place. And so just kind of putting, like overlaying a plot onto that, which is, I think, is it's really hard to do a story that takes place over 6 years, you know. But you already kind of had all the building blocks for it to make it work. It's kind of a really cool idea, I think. Like something that listeners that are trying to figure out what their movie is, you know, could kind of take that as an interesting entry.
I mean, I think that there's the mentality of like, oh, well, we've got some food coloring and Karo syrup in the cabin in the woods, or a convenience store in New Jersey, or whatever, you know, indie trope you want to lean into. We had a closet full of Christmas decorations and a great eggnog recipe.
Yeah, no, it's really good. We should make a movie about, I'm making a movie about podcasts. And if you've ever been on this podcast, you should help us make the movie. You should be a PA on this movie. Well, so I guess my last question kind of on that same line of questioning Chrissy is like, you think of like a Greta Gerwig or Zach Braff, or, you know, we've had people on the podcast too that are kind of working pretty, to us, successful working actors that were like, I just wasn't getting the parts I want. I mean, you even hear like Mark Wahlberg and stuff say, I just kept getting the like dumb beefcake part and I wanted good parts, so I had to make my own movies. I guess, was there a reason that you didn't make yourself the lead of the movie?
You know, when I was first writing the screenplay, I think there was a moment where I thought I would be the romantic lead, Natalie. But then as I wrote it, I've never, and some actors I think are really good at this, but when I think of writing something for myself, I think that gives just too much pressure. There's just a block of, you know, wanting to give yourself the juiciest role, or then not wanting to be so selfish so then you don't give yourself anything. And so I think sort of stepping away and not attaching myself to any role helped me finish the first draft. And then by the end of the first draft, I kind of just gravitated to the role of Annie, who sort of, you know, there are two couples you really follow, the couple who throws the party and then these two people who meet at the party and fall in love over the course of the movie. And, you know, in a funny way, I think because Annie is such the organizer of the party, there was a synchronicity between the director role and that role that actually made acting and directing at the same time really fluid. That's the sound of Matt taking a picture of me talking.
At see you next Christmas movie across all social media, but mostly Instagram. Anyway, sorry, you were saying something important.
I don't know.
I guess that is the thing. It's like you hear a lot of people that are actors and directors in the same film, like maybe.
I think there is a strategy around it. And I just don't know that I wish I were better at strategizing of this is the kind of role I've never played and this is what I want to play. But I think I was more drawn to this is the story I want to tell. And therefore, then where I fit in, I gravitated to a spot. But it was less about here's my chance to show off my acting chops and more about I want to make a film and more interested in directing and finding performances and less about showing myself off as an actor, which maybe is unwise as an actor. But I think,
I mean, there's a logistical challenge to it too, right? Like, you know, B and I can attest, it's hard to have your director in front of the camera, you know?
Yeah. We were like,
and so it was really nice that you had a really meaningful amount of screen time, but you know, the days where you weren't in front of the camera,
there was only one day I was not in front of the camera.
The day, but you know, you would literally, you'd transform, you'd put on your fanny pack and, you know, not have to, or we would have shot you out already or whatever. Like, there is a distinct shift between just literally wearing one fewer hat, basically.
Yeah. You know, the video tap, the device that they use on film cameras so you can see video of what you're recording. You know who invented that?
Jerry Lewis.
Yeah. Do you know? And you know why, obviously.
Because he wanted to see his takes. He needed video playback.
Yeah. He was like directing and acting. So it's interesting that like as a actor director, you have to have these other people probably like Matt and B that you trust to be like, yeah, you did it. You were in the frame.
Yeah, the
you
workflow
look good.
Is interesting. And I feel like in Killed in Action, we had a little bit of that discovery, but also on a feature, it's different and there's more days. And, you know, oftentimes it would be taping the rehearsal, watching it. But then also when you're shooting, you just don't have the time to watch every take. So it'd only be if I had a really big question about that take that I would rewatch it. But that requires a certain level of trust of your entire team, you know, to move forward, especially, you know, on an indie schedule where you might not get many takes per setup, mm-hmm. you know.
Did you have any, I feel like there were a few strategies that you had, a few like mantras. Because I think we had Josh Rubin on right before we started rolling and I asked him about it because he had just done Scare Me, which he stars in and directs. And I feel like he had a few pointers. What were some of the kind of like rules that you gave yourself or what did you focus on when you were trying to prep? And what changed over the course of production? Because it was a 16-day shoot, but we should say that like the first three parties were each basically long weekends. So we had time to recalibrate in between.
I would say preparation is the biggest thing. So I feel like I prepped harder as both a director and actor as maybe I would have. I mean, I'd like to say I'd prep really hard no matter what. But I think making sure that all those choices were made beforehand so that on the day I knew exactly what I wanted. And I created, and I feel like it might have been a guest on the podcast who had suggested like this, creating a blanking on what we called it, like a production Bible where I went through every single scene and I wrote down what the scene was about, what needed, you know, if there were any special department needs, but sort of why that scene was in the screenplay, why it was essential, so that going into every scene, I knew, okay, this is, you know, this scene is all about tension, you know, with this long married couple and we have to paint this picture. And so just knowing kind of what the goal of the scene was and having a North Star, then when we had to recalibrate because something, you know, we didn't have enough time or something had to shift, I knew what was important. But, you know, in prepping for Killed in Action, I sought out a lot of actor director interviews. And one of the things that really stuck out, Jodie Foster, who like as a child was my idol and who I wanted to be. She talked about, you know, the one sort of drawback of being an actor director is that you'll never surprise yourself with your performance because it's always going to be what you could imagine. You know, you can plan and plan and you might get it. Hopefully you'll get it, but there will never be the surprises you get with an actor who's not you. And I think that is a little bit, you know, if there is a drawback, I mean, you can plan and plan and that's wonderful and you have control, but you don't have that surprise element you get with every other actor on set.
Yeah. But I guess there's pluses and minuses. Like we had Zoe Lister-Jones on the podcast and she's, you know, she was telling us that from within the scene she's directing because she's setting a pace, she's setting a tone and she 100%. Is kind of infectious in like...
You can nudge. You want a performance to go a certain way. You can kind of push them that way with what you're giving them. Which yeah. is sort of fun.
And I imagine if an actor gives you something unexpected, someone you're acting with, you would maybe react to that in a way
That's
that
true.
You didn't expect.
Yeah, I think you might be underplaying. It's not like it's not a song that you're singing. Do you know what I mean? I think like the challenge maybe is just being in the moment, right? But like, I think when you were acting and...
Well, that's true, but there's nobody giving you direction that couldn't come, that wouldn't occur to you. You know, there's no surprises, which in a way is nice not to have surprises. But I'm just saying you don't approach it
But you don't know how the other person is going to.
That's true. I'm not saying it's like you're you know, a robot showing up. But I think you have the direction you want, and that is what you're chasing. And there's no surprise of like, oh, I never thought of the scene that way, other than reacting off of what's happening.
But were you a robot in Westworld?
No, not in Westworld. But I was surrounded by robots.
Oh, okay.
Seduced by a robot. You know, it's funny. It makes me think, putting on both host and producer hat, I think it sort of reminded me, Bea, I'd love your thoughts on this. There were moments where, because the production team is small, it's me and Bea and a handful of really wonderful, supportive, talented people. But like, you know, it's like Enrique, there's a handful of people, right? And because Chrissy is in front of the camera sometimes, Bea and I tried our hardest to at least have one of us on monitor for any of them, those moments. But if there was something hard about the shoot, besides all the regular indie movie hardships of like money and time and sleep deprivation and stuff, I think that was the thing that I think surprised me, I would say. What do you have?
You mean having us on, like, in terms of us just kind of having different hats and being in different places at the same time, or not being able to be in the same place?
I think not being able to be in the same place at the same time. Yeah, we had to delegate always.
Yeah. Yeah. I would agree. I mean, you know, I think that's the nature of indie filmmaking, right? It's like you're a producer and you're a PA, like, in the way that you all were putting Duvetine up in the morning. And, you know, I was running to get breakfast on my way in for the entire cast and crew. And
I do feel like sometimes I was like, I'm going to take fire watch. I need to look at my phone for a few minutes.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
And then you'd show up to set B and Matt would be like, did you bring breakfast for the rest of us? And you're like,
oh. Exactly.
Did you guys have a first AD?
We did. Although our first day of shooting, I'm sure we all remember this, even though maybe we could have blocked it out. We had two crew members, important AD and script supervisor, who were sick. And so the very first day, which is chaotic,
you
just
must
because
have been
it's the
making
first
out
day.
With each other.
And and then we didn't have our AD. Well, and I think that was one of the days that was the most challenging with Matt B, you know, having to cover other things and not having the privilege of being able to be on set the whole time.
Yeah.
Well, just getting everything up and running too, right? It's the first day. I mean, of course you have your challenges, but and not everyone has met yet. So there's not the unspoken language and the gelling that sort of happens naturally when you're a few days and, you know, weeks into shooting. So
yeah, we didn't have a second AD. And I think that made things extra challenging because the cast is so large that and we had, you know, a lean hair and makeup team and wardrobe team, and so it's just a lot of people to get through the works, and so kind of our poor AD, I feel like, was constantly like bouncing back and forth between base camp and set, just trying to get things in order, basically. Yeah
And then production was sort of doubling as the second AD too,
so. Right.
I'm curious, B, so you know, obviously kind of your main day job is, you know, you work in production and television, episodic television. How long were you on Brooklyn Nine-Nine for?
Since the beginning. So all 99 seasons. I did 152 of 153 episodes. So I did everything except for the pilot.
That's like this guy at my high school that had perfect attendance from K through 12. And then he was sick, like couldn't come to school, like one day of like the last week of school. I'm assuming, and I could be totally wrong because I don't know exactly like what you did on Brooklyn Nine-Nine, but I'm assuming you had a more creative hand on See You Next Christmas than you did on Brooklyn Nine-Nine. I guess, can you talk a little bit about like as a producer, like, when you are making creative choices versus when you are trying to like have other people make those creative choices?
Yeah, I think, well, sometimes I feel like on set, I tend to default to that because that's where my strengths lie, are the like the more managerial, like organizational aspects of it. Like I feel like sometimes I'd go down to set and everyone's like, oh God, B's here. That means that means we're running behind on sketch.
Not true.
Like she's here being like, speed up, or, you know, here's where we're at on time. It's a fun exercise for me to sort of go into the more creative space because my mind, I think, just tends to default to, like I said, the organizational logistics aspect of it. So I try to really lean into that, you know, in my projects outside of, you know, episodic television, because I have that luxury. And it's, I think, when you're dealing with something on a bit of a smaller scale, you also have, there's more of a creative say in that way versus a giant television show that has 150 plus people on it.
So are you the production manager? Is that your role?
Well, I ended Brooklyn as production supervisor.
Okay, production supervisor.
I was going to say it's a little bit easier, I think, for both of us when we're not in production to be more creatively oriented. Like you in casting, you were like super, super engaged. It's like, I think this is probably true for most people, you kind of default to the thing you are the best at when you're in the fire. When you're in crisis mode, it's like, okay, I will take care of this really challenging thing because it is exactly in my wheelhouse. And so I feel like I was like working on camera stuff while you were working on production stuff pretty frequently, you know?
Yeah.
But when the fire is, when the burner isn't quite so high, I think you get a chance to kind of, you know, take a step back and do a little bit more of the creative stuff. I feel like we really actively, especially the further in, worked harder at carving out and communicating about creative opportunities for each other, you know?
Yeah, agreed.
And I think it was a lesson. There was an arc to it, certainly. Like you had to be conscious about it, you know?
I was curious if you guys had like a meeting before you started shooting where it was, Chrissy was like, look, this is the type of feedback I'm open to. And this is the type of feedback I like, don't tell me you don't like my shot selection, you know, but do tell me if you see something better about art direction or something. And like, I'm assuming that B probably, it was like, hey, we want to hear what you think about this location or what you think about this camera packed or this DP or this, you know, angle, yeah, or art direction more than maybe people usually. And I'm sure with Matt, it's kind of like the opposite. Like, hey, we want you to help us figure out more like what we're having for lunch and less like why you think this light should be orange instead of blue.
Lunch was always covered.
Yes, I will say our production team was super stellar. I mean, I have to, you know, my roommate was the production coordinator, so I'm a little biased, but he had it all handled with our great assistant coordinator, Christiane. So we were not ever worried about lunch. It was always delicious.
Yeah. But your point stands of like, we have to kind of make a point of dialing it. Chrissy, were there instances, I can think of a few times you were mad at me about schedule, which is a different deal.
I don't think so. In thinking of that question, I feel like, and maybe it's because we've known each other for a long time and worked together, I never felt like there were things that were, you know, out of place or that I wouldn't accept hearing feedback on. Although that being said, I think there were certain things where if we disagreed, depending on the type of decision, I would win. So maybe I'm like, you know, but you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like a creative.
A creative thing on, you know, I think we were all always open for discussion, but there were certain things that were in different people's wheelhouse that we deferred to them on.
And did that extend into post also, like in the edit and all that stuff?
Yeah, I would say post in particular, B and I were purely like producers. Like we weighed in on notes and things like that, but in I think maybe a more traditional way, basically. Like I think B, again, speaking to like us falling into our wheelhouses, I did more post soup sort of work and B acted like the studio a little bit more. Like B was like on clearances and like keeping track of music cues, and I was like pushing files around, and Chrissy got to make the vast majority of the creative decisions, I would say.
And then they would be thrown back to both of you to give note, you know, like I think I was in the trenches with our editor Andy Young working on it. And then, you know, you both would see a cut and weigh in.
Yeah, but we would never be like, oh, I think there's a better take, because we know, you know, if there's a better take or not. You looked
right
more than we did.
Yeah. And sort of going back to your question earlier, Oren, I mean, we, in terms of communication, we we met every day after each day of shooting. We would have a meeting and then talk about the next day's work and really prep in that way. So I felt like, I always felt like communication was really open. And I mean, to the point where like, there were a couple weekends where my boyfriend came to set and he was like, oh, you guys like, we'll sit down and chat and make sure you have every, you know, get out any sort of conversations that need to be had, whether it's creative or more logistical. So I felt like the lines of communication were always open and it was, I mean, noticed by other people.
Well, I think by nature of the first half of the movie being shot at our apartment, we lived on set. And so right. And B would be the first one to get to set. So we had time to discuss both before and after.
So you guys would end the meeting and then you'd be like, B, can you leave the bedroom now? And you guys just like turn the light off. And
we'd be like, B, can you help us bring our bed down back to the floor?
To the floor. And we have to go downstairs to the other apartment.
Eat on this apple box.
I think it's so interesting that you said that you and Matt, Chrissy and Matt, got into a few disputes about the schedule. Because to me, that happens to me a lot where on the surface, it seems like a logistical thing. Like, well, I think, you know, we should do this now and the time of day or whatever. But I think like, it's also like this big creative fight sometimes. Like, I'll be like, you're giving 20 minutes to like the most important shot of the day. Like, why are you like, this is an important scene, you know, like we need to do this. And I'm always fighting.
They're all important. That's why we're shooting them.
That's absolutely not true. but also there's for me personally as a director, I'm sure like all directors, like I really prefer to shoot things in order when I can, you know, and freaking ADs, they want to shoot everything in this direction first and then everything in that direction first. And then we got this actor at this time. So we're going to stop and shoot this random piece of a scene in the middle.
We were lucky to be mostly chronological by nature of the film and the 6 years of the film. We shot each of those weekends was 1 year at a time.
Right. Oh, I'm curious, just like little tidbits. And obviously I've seen... Actually, I haven't seen the final cut of the movie, but I've seen a cut of the movie. What are some of the visual cues you came up with to let us know that a year has passed? Like, you know, obviously the most obvious thing that I think someone thinks of when they think of a project like this, like, oh, we'll have them have a beard in this mm-hmm. year and not have a beard, you know, and she's pregnant or not pregnant. Like, what are the things that you guys did to show how characters change over 6 years when you're shooting it over 16 days.
Well, I do think there was something fun about haircuts and wardrobe as being a telling sign. But from perspective,
what are the specifics of like the wardrobe, for instance? Like, were you trying to track years? Like, this was cool in 2015.
Well, we debated about whether we wanted to place it in time. And actually, with COVID and everything, I'm glad we didn't place it in time because we would have been going into 2021 and things like that. And that would have made it very weird. But, we purposely didn't make it specific to years, but you see the maturity of a character change. So like one of my favorites is you see Nina, who is the baker of the group. You see, you know, the first year she's wearing something really youthful and you kind of see her age up until she's, you know, she's fabulous every year, but it's like a different kind of fabulous.
But because we shot chronologically, we could do things like do haircut, like the romantic lead had a long hair, like he had, like, you know,
right, but you can only go in one direction, right?
Well, there was a bit of a challenge with that because there was one pickup that we had to have that was like where they go to get ice or whatever,
but that we had planned to have thankfully. So we put him in a beanie the year we knew that he would have a haircut for, because it was a car scene, so we couldn't shoot it at the apartment, so we could hide whether he had the man bun or not. But the other big thing we did visually was that we wanted the camera to really evolve. So the first 3 years, all the apartment years, are all handheld. And especially that first year feels the most sort of rough around the edges because it is supposed to be like not immediately post-college, but it's, you know, these people who, you know, they're still red Solo cups at their party.
Right. And they're into like Dogma 95 and stuff.
Yeah. I mean, and even like the lighting, like they have, you know, like they put in a red light bulb. So it just feels, you know, messier. And then as the couple ages and they're trying to be more sophisticated, you know, both in production design. So like the tree that used to be sort of multicolor hodgepodge suddenly is like white lights and is a little more sophisticated until finally the characters move into a house
and then the camera is on sticks the rest of the movie. And then by the end, we finally get camera movement and pushes and fun things like that. But you kind of, it's a subtle evolving of the camera.
Speaking of that, I don't know if it's okay to share, but you guys recently moved into a new house. Was that based on the movie? Is your life?
Yes,
based?
We watched the movie and we were like, we should move too.
That's awesome. I should make a movie about all the things I want in life.
Yeah.
Show it to my wife.
Self-fulfilling prophecy.
And end up with 5 motorcycles. B, I'm curious. Like, I know the, you know, so again, I don't mean to be late. I don't think the movie, it's an awesome movie. It looks great. Everything. It is an indie feature. You know, I've directed some indie features. I've worked on many features of all budget levels, you know, from like close to zero to whatever, a couple million. I know that you guys were doing kind of everything more or less by the book production wise. You know, you guys had permits. You guys did, you know, when we were, I visited the set one time and we were shooting, you know, on a sidewalk and everyone was wearing those vests that you're supposed to wear so the cars can see you. Can you talk a little bit about, like, let's say other people are listening and they want to make a movie for $200,000 or something. Can you make a movie and still do everything by the book with a budget like that? Like
I would say we
totally
did.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I think I feel like we're all on the same page about this, but for us, it was finding those people within our network that were great at what they do and the best at what they do and who are sort of willing to share their, you know, their time and their talents and stuff with us and with the movie. So yeah, I think absolutely you can do things by the book and do them correctly no matter what budget you're working with.
Yeah, it's rarely a financial thing. Look, permits are expensive. And, you know, I think it's fair to say that B is the more stringent of the two. I was a little loose. There weren't any permits on Squaresville. We'll put it that way. Right.
Right. Which is a web series you did 10 years ago.
Yeah. A long time ago. And had like a teeny budget. But so with the exception of a few things, most of the stuff is free and it just takes time. For instance, B and I permitted, you know, you can pay somebody to walk the entire neighborhood and get signatures and put up those signs that everyone's annoyed by that says, hey, we're shooting here and all this stuff. If you want to shoot in Los Angeles, B and I did it ourselves and it was terrible. The terrible is maybe an exaggeration, but it was like not fun and we were busy and we had a lot of stuff on our plates, but like, that's what you do if you don't want the cops to come and shut down your movie. And we couldn't afford to risk it. Basically, the lesson that I learned a long time ago is that the right way is the easy way, is the cheap way, is the fast way, even if it doesn't seem that way sometimes.
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, I'm curious, just nitty gritty, like how much does it cost to permit like a sidewalk to shoot on the street in LA?
It was around, when you have ad fees and all, it's about $1,300 with the permit and then with everything else that goes on top of that.
And that's for one day, or is it only for a few?
No, hours? It lasts quite a few days and you can put multiple locations on one permit. But then, you know, it depends to where you are in the U.S. I mean, we shot something up in San Francisco a few years ago and it was, you turn in your paperwork to the permit office and it was like, it was like $100 or $200 for like an insane amount of space. And it was just like, put some signs up and tell people that you're shooting here, which is so different from LA.
I thought San Francisco is notoriously difficult to film in. At least
we
when
saw
I lived
police
there.
Officers and they were like, we were like, oh, are they going to look for our permits? And they just wanted to watch us film. They were excited. Yeah, I was surprised in San Francisco that
that
was
is
cheap.
Interesting. Typically when I'm filmed out of town, it's like, yeah, when the police come, they're like, hey, you want us to close down the street for you?
People get really excited.
Yeah. But in LA, it's just a whole different ball game, you know? And so I guess do you agree with Matt's point that like you basically, it would be a bigger, you would lose more money by getting shut down on a day than by doing things the right way.
100%. Yeah. 100%. I mean, it's just, I think we have these conversations often too. It's like, okay, we're paying to do it well and for the peace of mind. And so then, you know, we can all go home knowing that we did the work correctly and that all of our bases are covered.
And so, Chrissy, what are like some big takeaways that you learned from directing your first movie? I mean, obviously you'd been on set like a bazillion times before that. You're married to a director. You've seen him do his work. You've directed short form stuff in the past. What was different about this feature, and like what kind of knowledge are you dropping us?
The stamina of doing a feature is different, you know, than doing a short. I mean, I have a few, this may be the most obvious piece of advice, but I think the notes you get in the beginning, you know, you write a script and you share it with people and somebody has a note. If you choose to ignore that note's going to keep coming up, you know, from different people. And so choosing whether that's a note, you know, that that's the hill you want to die on, or, you know, if you don't address it, it's just every stage of the process. And sometimes it's a choice of, yeah, I wrote that character because I wanted them to be that way. And so I don't care that you don't like them. I like them or whatever. But one that I think all three of you are very familiar with was the title of the film was originally What Are You Doing New Year's, which is the title of a song. But a lot of people don't know that song. We didn't actually end up using that song in the movie. But I fought for it because I really love that song. And I feel like there's like a clever flirtatiousness to it. But also it doesn't have Christmas in the title. So people were like, but this is a movie set at a Christmas party. When I hear What Are You Doing New Year's, I think it's a New Year's party. And so there was such a back and forth and I fought it all the way along and ultimately changed it clearly. and I don't regret it, but it's something that I probably could have saved a lot of the mental energy if I had just addressed it the first time I got that note when I wrote a draft of the first draft of the script.
We've talked about that a lot, that notion. And I think there's also the thought separate from like, oh, notes that like you maybe haven't decided whether you want to ignore or not. There's also that thing of like, it's not going to fix itself. You know, it's like if this thing doesn't work on a story level or a character level or something, it's not like you can improv it away or that your editor is going to magically have the solution. You know, I think that was a thing that you really highlighted for me specifically.
But is that really true? Like, were there things that you were worried about at the script level that once you got to the final film, you're like, oh, we didn't even, that wasn't even a big deal. Like, no one misses the fact that they like each other, you know?
Yeah, I don't know if there's anything I worried about, but, you know, I think there were things that I knew some people that bumped for some people that didn't bump for me. And I think I approached it, you know, in casting, thinking about it when we were on set, making sure we had takes that sort of gave us the span of how a character could react to something so we could craft the performance. But it is, you know, something I think those notes just continue to repeat themselves, you know, and it's a choice that I have to be okay that if, you know, in a review, somebody says, oh, I didn't like this part. I'm like, yeah, I chose to have that part and I stand by it. And I'm not sad that you don't like it, you know, but if there's something that is at all negotiable, and I think the discussion of it, you know, you find the things that you really push up against and then the things you're willing to compromise on. And, you know, sometimes it's hard to tell the difference between the two, but I just think notes will continue whether from that and from different people, you can kind of write it off as well. That's just, you know, one person's perspective, but I think oftentimes they would continue to come up.
Yeah. I don't know. I find that stuff super fascinating. You know, we've talked about this a million times on the podcast, but that Walter Murch talks about how, you know, in your script, you would describe a character, you know, he's 6 feet tall, wears a leather jacket, has blue eyes and smells like whatever, camels, lights. I don't know anything about cigarettes. So I don't even know how to reference one. And that's the only time in your screenplay that you mention it. But on camera, like 24 frames a second, you see he's wearing a leather jacket. You see his eyes are blue every time there's a close-up. You see all this stuff. And so someone might miss something in the screenplay that's like abundantly obvious in the film, you know, and vice versa. And you mentioned earlier that you had done this like breakdown of the script before the shoot where you wrote down what each scene is about and why it's essential to the movie. I'm curious, did you end up cutting any of those scenes out of the movie?
You know, there's no scene that is fully cut. There are two scenes that got trimmed a lot. And one of them, so the note that I'm talking about is one of the romantic lead is a difficult character. Both of them have flaws, which is sort of the point of the movie. We see them over 6 years and they both address it. They grow and finally are ready to be with one another. But, you know, the male lead can be a jerk in the beginning. You, like, we meet him and he's a bit of a jerk and sort of in that classic rom-com.
Based mostly pretty directly on Matt, right?
Very heavily on Matt. Yes. Just a total cad, says all the wrong things. But over time, you know, you sort of, his veneer cracks and you get to know him. And, you know, early on, I got notes of, well, is he unlikable? And so while we were casting, that was something we were really sensitive to, you know, trying to find the right balance of somebody who really fit the essence of the character and who could have that growth, who could play that guy who's sort of a jerk in the beginning, but also who has a softness and a vulnerability that finally you get to see by the end of the movie. But one of the scenes that we did end up cutting, well, it wasn't cut. We kept the beginning of the scene, but cut the sort of worst part, was one where he is just really awful. And I find it entertaining. Maybe if there's ever special features, it'll be released to the world. But he's a real jerk in that scene.
It made me realize, and especially when we were watching it with an audience at festivals, you know, the arc of a rom-com is tricky, right? Like, if you think of it as three-act structure, and the thrust of the movie is the audience wanting this couple to get together, right? Then the darkest night, the moment right before everything resolves, has to be the moment where you believe, for whatever reason, they're not going to get together. And in classic rom-coms, it's because someone is moving to the other side of the country and they're on the plane or something like that. You know, they've moved to Santa Barbara, they're getting married and they have to, you know, someone has to stop them from getting married to the other person at the last minute. But with something character-based like this, you know, it has to be a personality problem. And so that's a weird tightrope to walk where you're like, oh, okay, like, we have to believe that they're not going to work out. And the reason they're not going to work out is because they're not compatible. And we really like both of them, but one of them is in their own way. And that's a really tricky thing to keep an audience on your side for.
I would also argue, you know, When Harry Met Sally is maybe the best romantic comedy. And clearly anyone who watches the movie will know I have an affinity for that. But Billy Crystal at the beginning, he's, you know, chewing grapes and spitting the seeds at the window. He's awful, you know, and he continues to say inappropriate things and like, but somehow we're rooting for them. And so I think, and I think maybe it's my background as an actor, I really like characters who are likable, you know, and I think it's that balancing of act of finding enough moments to make us like them. And so hopefully we achieve that. But it was, you know, I think one of the larger challenges in the edit was making sure that we could keep the audience on board long enough, you know, to show his flaws and also, you know, still root for him in the end.
Yeah, it's a super tricky tightrope to walk, I think. You know, the, like, obviously a character is going to have a redemption at the end, but you need the audience on board with them in the first act, like ideally in the first 5 minutes, right? And you can, you see like a show like House of Cards where Frank Underwood, you know, a dog gets hit in the street and he goes to it and you think he's going to help the dog. And then he like kills the dog. And it's like, obviously they're kind of subverting this, the trope of like the someone helping the dog to make you
saving
like them,
the cat.
Saving the cat, whatever version of it. But in a way he's like killing the dog to put him out of his misery, you know, also. And then he looks straight to the camera and explains exactly why he's doing it. And so it's less about, I think, to me, and my feature, we cut out an entire character for this exact same reason. Not because she wasn't likable, but because she was like getting in the way of encouraging the audience to get on board with our other characters, you know. But there's Billy Crystal, and When Harry Met Sally is just like so charming and so funny and so relatable. It's like Larry David, right? He's like this awful character.
Who's only awful. He's awful, but we love him.
Yeah, but he's so funny. I mean, are you guys caught up on the new season of Curb? I mean,
not yet.
It's just, there's a scene where he just goes into the dentist's office and he, you know, you write your appointment time and your arrival time, right? When you sign into the dentist's office, and he's like, "What? Why do you need my arrival time? Like just so you can see how well I did at hitting my appointment time? Like, obviously I'm going to lie if my arrival time is after my appointment time. Like, how do you even trust this, you know?" And he's just being so annoying, but we're like, yes, you know, we feel the same way. So I don't know.
Although I have friends who don't like that show because they find him so unlikable. So I think, you know, that note is still coming up for those people.
Yeah.
And Larry David's okay with it.
Yeah, he doesn't care. He's like, that's the point.
Oh, man. I love that. Yeah, that show so much. B, can you talk about some takeaways you had? Have you produced other indie features?
No, this was my first. This was my first indie feature.
So what, as a producer, as like someone that's trying to put a movie together, you come from this kind of multi-million dollar big machine TV, you know, 150 person crew world. Like, what are some things you had to do differently, or some new things or attitudes that you had to have in order to, you know, finish making this movie?
To get it all done.
Yeah, to get it made.
One takeaway, and Matt, I know you'll agree, is it's really scary to be financing so close to when you're going to be shooting. And we made it, thankfully, but there were a couple of days where Matt and I would be like in the corner on the phone trying to sort of shield
crying blood out of our eyeballs. Yeah.
But in the end, it was actually something that I think served us, because we were really careful with our budget and how we were ultimately spending money. And then we were able to, you know, because we were careful with that, we had, you know, money that we could use in post. And yeah, so the big takeaway though would be, I guess if things were sort of in this perfect world, we'd have a little bit more time between when we're financing to when the start of principal photography.
I would agree. People always have cash flow problems,
yeah.
I guess.
I don't think we've heard of one indie film that had all their money raised before they started shooting, you know?
But I think B's point is, like, we definitely would have spent more money than we should have if we knew what that total number would be. If we knew that we were going to raise, like on WeFunder, I think the number is like 140 or something like that, we would have spent more than we should have. Not have enough money for music, not have enough money for title sequences, you know, all the clearances, all the stuff that you don't want to spend money on because it's not sexy or cool, or you can talk yourself into believing that you're not really going to need that stock footage
fine.
Or whatever.
Yeah.
It's all fine. Yeah, yeah. All of that stuff comes to get you. And like Festival Rights is a good example, Warren. So our music supervisor was able to secure rights in perpetuity to all of the music that we had, so that when we go to distributors and sell the movie, we don't have to go back and like pay money out of an MG or whatever. Like, there's a lot of that stuff that's really annoying and stressful, and we were lucky. And I would count us as, you know, precautious producers. You know what I mean? I think there's just stuff that bubbles up that, you know, you don't realize it's going to cost you $20,000.
Right. Sorry. I like to have a specific type of coffee when I come to visit the set. So B, what is a thing that people will try to skimp on in like an indie production that they shouldn't? Like, to me, in commercials, it's like, I don't care if the budget is like $5,000, you know, I think something should go to music and something should go to color, where I think a lot of times that's not really budgeted for. Like, what are the things in an indie film that people maybe aren't budgeting for that are things that really move the needle in a way that you can tell us about?
You mean to get a distributor, or just in general, like, or to get cast and crew on board? Because I will say, I guess from that aspect, something that doesn't cost that much money but really does go a long way, and it's something that, you know, we did on KIA, that we were doing on Squaresville, and that we, you know, brought over to See You Next Christmas, is we would ask people what sort of treats they liked. And, you know, if someone's like, oh, I love Twizzlers, that's something that's really easy to have on set that will make people happy and sort of create a nice environment. And I think that I had a boss once that was like, everything's about food and parking. And so, you know, if you think about it, I mean, it's kind of true, right? Like people love food. And, you know, if you're having meals that are just like the same, like sandwich platter every day, like that's a little thing. And yeah, it's not that expensive, but if you're, you know, taking the time to see what people's likes are, especially with an indie film, a lot of people are maybe taking cuts with their rate to do this project. You want to find other ways to sort of compensate them because they're giving their time and their craft and knowledge.
We were alluding to Enrique before, who took care of many, many, many things, but in addition to lunch, and it was, it's funny to me because he, you know, works on, like B works on all sorts of big fancy TV shows. And so lunch was a microcosm of something that was just very clear to me of like, oh, you can take your experience of knowing how to do something at a super high level and deliver, because you have relationships with vendors or you just know who to call. Our food was always top notch and was way cheaper than I ever imagined it could be, and was way nicer than I thought we could with the amount of money that we had. And it was just like, oh, you just know how to do this better than me going to Costco. The crappy version would be like me going to Costco and getting a bunch of like rolls or whatever and not knowing how to do it right, rather than like getting a catering deal or whatever. And that's, I know we're joking about the food stuff, but I think that like having a crew that has those experience points accrued already pays for itself in ways that are really hard to quantify. If you're dumb like me, but if you saw it, you're like, oh, I didn't know lunch could be this good for $100 for the entire crew or whatever. It was staggering, you know?
Well, yeah, it's interesting. A lot of, you know, there's this like, when people first start working in film, there's like this idea that like, oh, all you got to do is feed these people and they'll come like work for free or whatever. But then you talk about a movie like your movie where you're actually getting professional, you know, professionals in their field to come work for a really reduced rate. And it's not just about feeding them, but it's maybe trying to feed them at the same level that they're used to being fed on these like other productions. So, you know, obviously you're not going to have dedicated people walking around giving them little quesadillas or whatever. But what you're saying, B, is like the such an easy thing. Like, hey, what are some snacks you like? And like, hey, we're taking special, we're paying attention to your needs specifically, sounds like a big bonus.
I think an offshoot of that, when we were crewing up, one of our big questions to everybody was why would you want to be a part of this? Because not why would you want it? What are you thinking? But I think making sure that everybody who was a part of it, that this was an opportunity for them in some way. Because I think, you know, sometimes, especially in the low budget world, you think, well, I'll go to my friends and ask for favors. And I think something I realized is that when a friend is, if it's a pure favor, you know, another job comes up and they have to take it, you know, because there's nothing really in it other than, you know, like wanting to help out their friend, which is wonderful and appreciative. But, you know, finding for everybody what the opportunity was, because I think a lot of the reason that we could get, you know, people who worked in network TV, I mean, part of it, of course, is B's wonderful relationship with many of them. But also some of them, it was an opportunity to be a department head when they're always the assistant. And so finding what an opportunity.
Or to do their first feature.
Yeah, to do their first feature.
Right.
You know, finding what
or
it is.
Or this grip accidentally dropped 10 C-stands on someone. No one will hire him. We'll take it.
That is not how we hired. But you know, or I mean, I remember on Squaresville this happened, where our AD had a lot of experience, but the thing that was interesting to her, we had had one season of Squaresville that got distribution, and that was interesting to her because she had finished her thesis at USC and had a web series that she had written and directed. And so she wanted to ask Matt questions how he didn't. So she was willing to do, you know, AD work that she would charge a lot more for the ability to talk to Matt and have that sort of mentorship opportunity.
Next time she should just talk to me. I'll ask him. that is interesting. It's actually something that Matt talks a lot about, which is when we're hiring for the podcast, which is not something we do a ton, but like, you know, hey, we can't pay you a ton of money, but what can you get out of this?
It's, yeah, sometimes
it's hard to find people in that, you know, in that method.
But it's something you genuinely want, because you want people who want to get, who you feel like you're not taking advantage of, but that they are getting something out of it. And it might be surprising what they want of just, you know, oh, it's really interesting. I want to move into directing. So I want to be on a set where I can watch a director, because I'm, you know, in an office all the time. So it's exciting to meet to PA and get to watch it, which you're like, okay, I'm happy to let you come.
I would say also, we're pretty good about paying it forward. You know, I think you've hired, I don't know how many people from the movie already, or hooked them up with jobs, which is a thing that, yeah, you kind of have to like recommending people and putting your money where your mouth is, and, you know, making sure that you follow up with them and, you know, create as much opportunity for them as you can.
That's cool. That's why B has like 7 personal assistants now. Like, okay, you earn this. You get to pick up my dry cleaning.
Oren, to answer an earlier question, though, that I'll kick over to you too. Title sequences was something that we really underestimated, and really budgetarily, and also just kind of on a creative level. I think there was a plan and it didn't totally work, and so pivoting. And you know, it's literally it's frame one of the movie is this title sequence. And I think it does do a really good job of setting the audience expectation for the style and tone and voice and level of quality, frankly, for the film. So I thought you two could talk a little bit about that.
Well, I'll jump on. Sort of, it made me think of another point about, you know, we did shoot chronologically. And while I highly recommend that if you can, the beginning of your movie, the first scene of your movie, don't shoot that on day one, you know, because everyone's still finding their footing. Everyone's, you know, the crew is getting used to working together. The stakes are just different. And so I think the title sequence, part of what we had planned, and on the page it read really well, but I think, you know, I hadn't visualized it the way I, you know, once we got into the edit, I realized like, oh, this isn't exactly how I imagined. And then we were lucky to get an incredible title designer who really, I think, sets the tone for the movie. And then, you know, but that's something we learned in post that we needed.
Yeah. Did you shoot the first scene on the first day?
You were there for it.
You were there.
Yeah, that's your cameo is
what, on the sidewalk?
Yes.
That was not your first day of shooting.
That was our first day of shooting, yeah.
I thought you'd already been in your apartment and stuff.
Well, we had shot a few things earlier in the day, but they were all for the first 10 minutes of the movie, including the very first shot of the movie is that what was on the sidewalk.
Oh, cool. The Get Out shot.
Exactly.
Yeah, we shove Oren into a trunk. It's a weird thing for a Christmas movie.
Yes. They're like, which of our friends would fit into this Mazda Miata trunk? That's how I get my parts, folks. And so I guess my last question for B is, like, having worked on those big shows, like, what are some of the skills that did translate to working on a smaller indie feature?
I think, you know, the skills in both sort of camps, like the indie world and the big studio world, go pretty well hand in hand. Like, I think because I'm so used to going by the book and having so many different people to go to when I'm doing the bigger budget shows, it's like, okay, now I know I have to, you know, I know that we should talk to a lawyer about this. I know that we should get a clearance company on board to look at the script, and then to have someone who's going through every iteration of, you know, all the cuts that come out. And then, like Matt said earlier, like different relationships with vendors or other people who I know at work that, you know, are people who might want to jump on to a lower budget project to get different experience. And yeah, I mean, I think, and you know, my mentors come from that space. I'm very close with my producer from Brooklyn, and he really took me under his wing. So sort of having that opportunity to always bounce stuff off of him has been really helpful, and that, you know, seeing him produce has influenced the way that I produce indie, you know, things.
I would just echo how invaluable the mentorship that B has had and benefited from. Like, I know how much I personally have benefited third hand from all of it, you know, or second hand, I suppose. But so, like, just having a person who, and these producers, you know, they've made a bunch of movies themselves. They've made a bajillion episodes of TV. You know, literally every person who's listening to the show has seen something that they have made, right? So it's like the experience really speaks for itself. And so being able to just, like, in a pinch, shoot someone a text and have peace of mind, or know that we need to go back and fix something or whatever, was truly, truly invaluable. And I think speaks to a thing that we kind of hammer home of, like, just being in the building, quote unquote, you know, being around other people where you can kind of build your network out, I think was a thing that really, really helped us. And then the other thing that, B, I think you're underestimating, because you just habitually cross every T and dot every I, but, like, the discipline that a studio drills into you, I think makes things like delivery and wrap out much, much, much easier. Every indie producer I've ever known has been, like, tearing their hair out, like, hasn't slept in 3 weeks because they're delivering the movie. And it's not because post is really hard. It's because they're trying to track down that piece of artwork and get the contract signed and this and that. And we had those. We had our fair share of those little, you know, hanging to do's, or when rewatching a movie, realizing, ah, shoot, there's something that we need to catch or whatever. But, like, the peace of mind of having delivered a, I don't want to say perfectly, but I'm very confident in the clearances and delivery aspects of it. And it's because
it's one of the best cleared movies I've ever seen.
Sure. Yeah, it is, though. And so, like, we're not gonna, like, I'm not worried about errors and omissions insurance, even though we have it. Do you know what I mean? And but I guess what I'm trying to say is that, like, if you are studious and fastidious about getting location releases, getting appearance releases, getting art releases, and calling if you need something, or if you need to double check on something, all of that stuff adds up to a successful release. And, like, we personally know plenty of filmmakers who didn't know all of the things that they needed to do and ended up in some real trouble, not being able to afford a song anymore, or not having to cut a scene or blur a face. Like, what a bummer to,
in a fight with Bruce Springsteen.
But, you know, like, we've seen movies where you see a piece of artwork that's blurred in the background. It's like, dang, you spent 3 years of your life working night and day and, like, paying somebody to hang that up and put and frame it in the right way and all, and then color grade it and put it in the edit. It's like so much work to mess it up because you didn't get somebody to sign the piece of paper, or you didn't double check that it was cleared in the first place. It's such a heartbreak to me. And so, everybody, just do that stuff.
Yeah.
Please.
Yeah. And I'm, well, but there was something, Matt, you and I were texting a few weeks ago, and I was like, oh, you know, I was a little panicky about something, and you were like, I rely on your anxiety.
Yeah.
That's awesome. Okay. Release forms. I'll work on that.
I know it's not cool. It's important.
Oh, my last two features, every freaking picture in the background's blurred out. It sucks. Okay. So Chrissy, so you made a movie. Now what? What does this mean for your career?
Oh, skyrocketing. I think that's what happens next, right? Well, I have that other feature we were trying to get made.
Into the Fog.
Into the Fog. Won a development grant. So we have some cash in the bank for that. And so the next thing on the horizon is developing that out further. I'm rewriting the script. And
you were the lead in that script.
Yes.
Right?
Yes. And I'm planning to be on this one. So
you,
I guess,
still want to direct it as well.
Yes. Yeah. And so putting that together and figuring that out and starting all over again.
I think there is something about just, like, having had a feature made. I think there are a lot of intangible things that you know, you don't realize. People don't say, like, oh, we hired you because of your resume specifically sometimes, or we took the meeting because of the resume, or people respect you a little bit more because of the resume. But I think that all of that stuff in tangible ways and more overt ways kind of is important. We've seen it. I mean, we see on the podcast all the time.
I will say when you have a movie that's like in theaters or coming out or just being released or available in streaming, whatever, obviously, you know, I don't think any of us go to as many parties as we used to, but there is this like weird confidence you have when you're like, oh yeah, I just finished this movie. It's coming out on this date. It's doing this, it's doing that. That makes you like you charismatic in a certain way that people do want to like work with you.
So I better capitalize on this window of confidence.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to make another movie, I think it's, yeah, from my experience and just the people we've interviewed on the podcast and stuff is like when you have things happening, people want to work with you. And so it's a great time to get into
momentum
the fog going
for the next. Yeah.
Yeah. And also, I mean, I guess I'm curious, are you interested in like directing other people's stuff or are you kind of?
I definitely would be interested. I think, you know, I think of the three, writing, directing and acting, writing is the one that maybe comes least easily to me. I think I love.
Wait, can we?
What?
Can we talk about your morning page number?
Hey, tomorrow is 2,200 days in a row of my morning page.
Do you know about this, B?
No.
Do you know what morning pages are?
No.
So there's this book, The Artist's Way. Maybe this should be my unpaid endorsement.
Yes, now I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
So one of the things you do in The Artist's Way is you write, you know, three pages. Is it three pages? Well, it's funny because I use this website, like 750 words a day to sign in, and it tracks it and logs it, which is why I know how many days I've done in a row. So that's the one consistent thing in my life is I do those pages every single day.
The one thing.
Wait, and it's and just to inform listeners, if that doesn't make sense, why you would do that? It's like the idea is that you're exercising your writing muscles every morning, even if all you're writing is like, I have no idea what I want to write today. I don't care.
Which
I don't
many days that is, or it's just getting out all of the frustrations and tensions you have. You know, you could spend all the pages saying, you know, I'm not inspired today. Why am I doing this? Why do I keep this up? But having that consistency is really nice.
Do you work out your features and stuff during your morning pages ever?
Sometimes. I feel like it's less creative writing and more sort of the personal demons that come out in the morning pages. But I think when I have a task at hand, I'll talk through sort of a question of the script. And oftentimes it really helps doing that. But right. Usually it's more me just complaining.
So for 2,200 days straight, you have written your morning pages every single day.
Well, 2,199. We'll see if I make it to 2,200.
2,199. So including weekends, 7 days a week.
Yes. Yes. Holidays. Yes.
Yom Kippur.
Even on Yom Kippur.
Well, I don't know if that's allowed.
Five years, three quarters.
Yeah. I remember like, the day I was at like 500 consecutive words and I missed a day and started over. And I was like, well, you got to start somewhere. So
you're like the Beeple of morning pages. If I don't know if you guys know who Beeple is, but he did NFT. Sell a $69 million NFT. Yeah. He makes art every single day and posts it online. So it's interesting that as a person who for 2,200 days in a row has not missed one.
Yeah, writing does not come easy. But I think it's different when you're plotting and writing a story. Because I think my interest lies in, like, I love watching character, like I could watch the most boring film where people just talk and nothing happens. And I know that is not fulfilling for audiences. And so the act of, you know, coming up with a story and a plot to me is the hardest challenge. Whereas I think interpreting a character or working with actors or, you know, once there is a script, that's something that I understand how to dig into. But writing is really hard. I mean, every part is hard, but that's the one that I think I struggle the most with.
Yeah. My take on it is like writing of all these different disciplines that we want to make movies, or that we use to make movies. Writing is the one that you do 100% like by yourself, you know?
Yeah. I think the solitude of it is really hard. The others are collaborative.
And I think you can't do the others without the script. Like, that's also the first step. And so I think I started writing only by necessity, because it was like I wanted to make things and nobody was handing me a script to direct, you know? And so I just started writing them, and I knew I had access to me to act in them. So I think my it was less about making a showcase for myself and more about using the resources I had.
Right. Yeah. And of all the partnerships you hear about in Hollywood, probably the most common one is like the writing partnership, because it's, you know, it's a way to not do it alone, because in every other, as a director, as an actor, as, and you have other people to like work off of.
Well, the accountability of that, I would imagine, would be really nice.
Yeah. Well, cool. Well, what's, how do we see the movie? November 9th.
Tuesday, November 9th. Available on digital platforms such as iTunes, Amazon, Vudu, Xbox. Am I forgetting one?
No, those are the big ones.
Google.
You could go to Google. Yes, Google Play.
Yeah, YouTube. If you buy movies on the internet, you can do it.
Cool. So see you next Christmas. And what are you guys?
ChristmasMovie.com.
See you next Christmas. And it's SEEYOU.
Correct. Correct. Thank you.
And what are you guys doing New Year's?
Watching this movie on loop.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, cool. Well, you guys should all check out the movie. It's awesome. And it is based on Matt and Chrissy. Matt, it does have a character in there. So if you're a fan at all of Matt Enlow, which I don't know why you would be.
Yeah, cameos. You can see also B is a background player in the movie as well.
Right. But Matt is like a character in
my
the movie.
My voice is in there.
No, that's true. I mean, it's an interpretation whether you think that role is truly Matt or
it's
not.
It's pretty Matt. Like when I was giving you guys notes, I was like, you know, the Matt guy.
Sure. The one married to Chrissy. Also, if you're a fan of Brooklyn Nine-Nine, we failed to mention, though, Mark Evan Jackson. Paul Welsh. We got a handful of Janet Varney, who's not on Brooklyn, but should have been. I don't know why she wasn't. But we've got a fun list of cameos as well. A lot of Jenny Lorenzo. That's right. That's right. So there's a lot of different reasons to watch the movie as well.
Right. Even if you don't celebrate Christmas, especially if you don't celebrate Christmas. You know, some of the best Christmas albums are by Jewish people.
Yeah. I mean, this is like a diehard. Well, it's like your alternative Christmas programming, but a little Christmassy as well. I hope that people can watch it with their parents and their jaded teenage children.
I mean, there's a lot of Jesus mentions in it, though, right?
Santa does marry a Christmas prince. So there you go.
Okay, cool. Well, you guys want to join us for some unpaid endorsements?
Unpaid endorsements.
So I'll kick it off. I got a real theoretical one. It's not like a TV show or anything. The thing that I kept thinking about and we kept returning to in this conversation is the idea of community. I think that the main theme of how we got this movie made is like establishing and maintaining friendships, whether that's at work or in your artwork. You know. We couldn't have made the movie without B's Brooklyn Nine-Nine family. Truly, you know, we all met together, Squaresville, and there were a good number of other people. Like, and Chrissy also, we didn't mention it, but like workshopped the entirety of the film basically through a group called Sandbox that we've talked about a little bit. And actually, they had a meeting a couple weeks ago, and there were a number of Just Shoot It listeners who came through, which is really exciting. But so basically, what I'm endorsing is not just Brooklyn Nine-Nine or Squaresville or Sandbox, or Just Shoot It. It's finding community. I'm saying you have to be active about forming those groups and sometimes giving them a little structure, a writer's group, an accountability partner, a game night. Those are all different versions of it. But I think that I'm just reminded that independent filmmaking in particular, but just in general life, is about community. And so I think as we're kind of finally emerging from this pandemic and thinking about our next projects and all of that stuff, I think that I am endorsing being proactive about officially creating community for yourself, because I think it will pay dividends.
Wouldn't you say that's what the movie's about?
Oh, that's the theme of the movie. Dang, I didn't even understand the movie we made. Oh no, shoot, that's so obvious.
I think you stole this endorsement from my rabbi.
Sounds like a smart rabbi.
Yeah, he's okay. Awesome. Cool. Well, thanks, community. NBC. That's right. Peacock. Streaming on Peacock.
B, what you got? I think I know what you're going to say.
Yours was so good, Matt. Mine, well, in a broader sense, would be finding something that is outside of film and television or outside of the business that you can do and then come back to your work and your art with fresh eyes and a fresh mind. So for me, that's exercise. I love to spin. Matt, Christy, and I would spin.
RIP flywheel.
I know.
B would spin for an hour every day of
before
shooting.
We would shoot.
Yeah, we would have 2 or 3 hours of sleep, and B would be like, "Yeah, I totally worked out today."
Yeah, some form of exercise just to be able to, you know, come back with like a fresh pair of eyes and a fresh mind. And I've just always felt like that's helpful. So it might, you know, it might not be exercise for everybody. It might be, you know, like reading, or it might be playing a board game or going out and taking a walk or whatever it is that you know, can do to step away and then come back and see something in a different light.
Cool. So don't be a film nerd.
Christy, what you got?
Well, I was thinking about it. This kind of was a thought based on a question earlier, so I'm just going to use that.
That's the point, sure.
Even though I feel like for all the years of your podcast, I've been like, I could do an unpaid endorsement easy. Then when you're put on the spot, it's like, I can't think of
anything.
You're
like, microphone? audio technical.
Yeah, this microphone is my endorsement. No, write in your script a line that explains your movie. Something you would use in the trailer that can be an easy soundbite. You can cut it from your movie, but have something like, oh, here we are at the annual party again. I mean, that's the worst version of it. But I think when you're cutting a trailer, you realize having something really on the nose that explains either a character, the plot, what's going on is a real asset when you're cutting a trailer.
Yeah, the premise to the movie. Our lives would be much,
I love, yeah, our trailer, and it worked out really well, but
I really wish your main character walked into the, you know, party and is like, in a world where parties are happening, I'm here looking for love.
I've been here for 6 years and I keep hoping to find love.
So my,
I mean, we would have put that in the trailer not in the movie, because that would have been really bad.
Yeah, my friend Adam Mays cuts trailers for like a bunch of like huge studio films, and he told me, he's like, that's like every movie has that problem, that no character ever says what the movie's about. And he's like, we've got every like voice impersonator. We got John Hamm, we got Eddie Murphy, we got all these different guys, John Travolta, that we basically call in to, and we write a line for them that says that, you know, and just play it like off screen, because it's a real problem. But yeah, but I always think like thinking of your trailer when you're thinking,
yeah,
of the movie.
Yeah, and people say sometimes thinking of your poster when you're writing the movie, which that I always was like, what? No, you want to write what you don't want to think of that. But I mean, it is thinking about the marketing, thinking about what makes,
well,
your
it's
movie.
What's the hook of your movie. Yeah. And I love your poster, by the way. It's so cool.
Kaplan, what you got?
I got two. First one is this website I just used today. I actually got it from Film Riot. It's called Avatar SDK. And if you need a 3D model of yourself, it's a pretty crappy 3D model, but like you go to this website, gives you this QR code you scan with your phone, and then your phone asks you if it can take a selfie of you, and you take a selfie, and then the website gives you a 3D model of your face and your head and your shoulders. So if you want to like chop your head off, or that's what they did in the Film Riot video. You know, it's not a great model, but like in the distance, you know, you can, it's kind of like an easy free way to make like a digital double of yourself, or at least your head. And my other endorsement's really weird. I think Matt will think it's extra weird and maybe even potentially ask us to cut it out. But a director was pitched to us today. His name is Corey Don Wagner, CoryDonWagner. And he has a website, CoryDonWagner.com. And I don't know if we'll have him on the podcast or not. I don't know if he's the perfect fit at the time with what we're looking for, but his website is really cool. He's a commercial director, And he does like amazing commercials. He has like this incredible Virgin Galactic commercial that's like this epic space thing. He's done Samsung. He's done, you know, United Colors of Benetton. But if you go to his website and you click on a commercial, you know, you can watch the commercial and he has like all the credits. But if you scroll down, he has all these behind the scenes things. He'll have storyboards. He'll have animatics. He'll have like just visuals of inspiration that he used to come up with the look of his commercial. Sometimes like the set build or some of the actors or tests they did. And it kind of made me rethink my entire website. Because I kind of do that, but I kind of just put them in random places like Instagram, which is, you know, I think not a bad place to put them. But like I could actually put the making of on my website under the commercial that is posted there. So I thought it was a really cool format and it's really interesting to see what kind of imagery inspires his commercials, you know, which is cool. Because I think it's not stuff that is coming from the clients or the agency. It's him as a director trying to figure out how to hone in on a look of a commercial. So anyway, CoreyDonWagner.com. Pretty cool way to break down your work. I thought it was cool. Okay. If anyone has any questions, go see You Next Christmas. Tell us what the movie's about, and then we will agree to answer your question, which you can email to us at justshootitpod@gmail.com.
I'll say if any listeners pre-order the movie or order the movie and they watch it and they tell me who their favorite character is, I'll make Oren review their reel. I'm trying to think of a good incentive. If you watch it, let us know, basically, is the real answer. But like, yeah, I'm happy to answer any questions or look at your reel or note your short film or whatever. I'd do that anyway, but if you watch the movie, that's especially good.
Matt will not do that anyway.
I will do it for this.
Okay, for this, but you wouldn't do it anyway.
Well, I answer a lot of questions, and I have made an advice podcast for like 6 years. I'll like keep making the show. Yeah, that's
see
right.
You next
that's
right.
We need like an AI that just takes emails and tells people which episode to listen for the answer.
Boy, that would be
too,
great.
For the answer.
That'd be cool.
Yeah. And coffee meetings too. I saw Anna Akana posted this video about how as she's like gets into her 30s, she has decided to stop like just going to things that she doesn't want to go to. Like coffee with people that she's not that interested in like meeting. and I was like, oh yeah, I guess you could just say no. No, thanks. anyhow, well, thank you so much for coming to this podcast, for commuting all the way over here.
B, how can listeners keep track of what you got going on?
I guess Instagram is my most public space. So Beezus218 is my Instagram handle. BEEZUS218.
Wait, BEEZUS?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, 218.
Yeah, no A in the Beezus.
Right, Beezus 218. Correct, yeah. That's one of my favorite Bible
verses.
Verses, yeah.
Old Testament guy.
What about Christy?
You can find me, Christine Weatherup, on Instagram, ChristineWeatherup.com. And then you can find the movie, See You Next Christmas Movie, on Instagram, on Facebook, on just See You Next Christmas Movie.
Instagram's the main .com.
Channel. Yeah, Instagram's the best way. And like Oren said, SEEYOU, see you. No
not
abbreviations. Yeah, not the letters.
Cool. Matt?
Well, you can follow me at Mr. Bad and Low. I've got this podcast called Just Shoot It, and you can follow it across all social media at Just Shoot It Pod. You can email us any questions at justshootitpod@gmail.com. And check out all of our old episodes and the stuff that we talked about at justshootitpod.com.
Yeah, and I'm at O Kaplan on everything. I'm at Smitey Pilig on Twitter. And this episode was edited by the amazing Sarah Weirda. The music you're listening to is from the Free Music Archive and the artist Jazar. And thanks for your time. Rate us on iTunes if you're bored. We'll catch you next time.
Thanks, everyone. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye. Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.